Bronwyn Naylor from RMIT University, and I'm the compere for tonight. And Sisters in Crime Australia and Sir Zelman Cowan Centre at Victoria University welcomes you to what is its 11th annual Law Week event, which is called, as you know, Sex, Crime and Punishment. It's also the second year that Sisters in Crime has partnered with the Sir Zelman Cowan Centre to present Law Week, and we give special thanks to Professor Cathy Laster for helping this happen. So can I ask you then to welcome our esteemed panel? We have Detective Senior Sergeant Marnie Johnson, middle there. Sergeant Kerry Wall at the end. And Magistrate Belinda Wallington. So before we proceed any further, on behalf of Sisters in Crime Australia, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation on whose traditional lands we're meeting tonight and pay my respects to all elders past and present. Now, in terms of the procedure, what we'll do is that I will sort of facilitate, or I imagine I'll just begin and then they will completely take over a conversation with our panellists for an hour, and we'll then have some time for questions. So, introductions to our speakers. Detective Senior Sergeant Marnie Johnson, as I've mentioned, she is the officer in charge of the Serious Sex Offender Specialist Response Unit. She has 24 years service under her belt and a strong background in investigating sexual offences. She's worked with both the Sexual Crime Squad and the SANO Task Force, which she may have to explain, focusing on institutional child sexual abuse. Marnie enjoys reading true crime books. Vicky Petritis and Anne Rule are her favourite authors. Well placed.
Perfect placed. I'm not nervous at all now.
And Marnie does admit to having watched Law & Order SVU on more than one occasion. Next, Senior Sergeant Kerry Wall. She's managed and been a member of the sex offences team at the Melbourne Prosecutions for the past 4 years. Her area of expertise is child exploitation material offences, historical matters with multiple victims, and complex rape and sexual assaults prosecuted in the children's courts. She's recently been promoted to the rank of Senior Sergeant at the Policy and Project Team at Family Violence Command to oversee the implementation of the recommendations from the Royal Commission into Family Violence. And one of those recommendations is the blending of processes and procedures around the investigation of sex offences and family violence. Her favourite crime shows are The Fall, The Wire, and Law & Order SVU. She reads a lot of true crime as well and a bit of crime fiction, but she's rather limited at the moment to her law textbooks as she's currently completing her Bachelor of Laws. And Belinda Wallington, Supervising Magistrate for Sexual Offences. Belinda was a specialist criminal lawyer with Slades and Parsons prior to her appointment to the Magistrates Court in 2003. She's currently based at Melbourne Magistrates Court and she travels every couple of months to sit in the Sex Offences List and the Koori Court in Mildura. Crime fiction is one of her favourite forms of fiction since reading Murder in the Collective whilst working in a feminist collective at a women's refuge. She also enjoys crime shows such as Prime Suspect, Scott and Bailey and The Bridge. And she likes her protagonist sassy but flawed. Okay, so we'll begin now, and as I said, I'll present some starting off questions to our panel, and then we've got some time at the end of this for your questions. So just as a little bit of a background, we probably all saw the media reports not long ago about what I might refer to as the Geelong case, involving a young woman who decided not to proceed with her allegation of rape. So there was a lot of press coverage of that case and of the issues that it raised. And in particular, we would have seen how the reporting of that case raised lots of concerns about police and court practices in relation to sex crimes. And some of you may have read the response, the opinion piece that was published in The Age by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Marilyn Warren, in response to that story, pointing out that there have been many new protective procedures put in place to reduce the trauma of a trial for child complainants. There's a lot of media discussion about sex offences and how they're dealt with in the criminal justice system. And as we've seen, we have a fantastic expert panel to talk to us a bit more about what happens in practice for people working in the justice system in this area. So I thought that to start, it would be helpful just to ask our panel, each person in turn, just briefly to give us a bit of background about themselves and about the work that they're doing. I'm going to start, Belinda.
All right. Well, the role that I do is supervising sex offences. I'm based at Melbourne, but I'm in the process of trying to have consistency in management of sex offences across the state. So, and then that's my challenge for the first half of this year. But the sex offence list is actually 10 years old. We've had a supervising magistrate for sex offences for 10 years, and it came out of the recommendations of the Victorian Law Reform Commission on sexual offences that made a lot of recommendations of an evidentiary and a procedural basis. And one of the recommendations was that all the agencies or organisations that dealt with sex offences, because of their unique and also difficult nature, should specialise. And so the OPP had a specialist prosecution unit, the VicPol did, and the court commenced a sex offence management list. So what it means is, because even though a lot of the more serious sex offences are actually dealt with in the county court, they all come through the magistrate's court. And if they're going to the county court, they may well have a preliminary hearing to see if there's sufficient evidence in which a jury could convict before they go to the county court. So we have all of them and we case manage them heavily.
Thank you. As was stated in the opening, I'm currently in charge of a unit that manage the serious sex offenders in the state of Victoria. Those individuals are on a post-sentence scheme, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later on. It'll make it a little bit clearer. But prior to managing SOSRU and prior to being an investigator with the Sexual Crime Squad, I helped implement some significant reforms across Victoria Police in training investigators in sexual assault, moving away from having one unit that deals with the complainant and then detectives that deal with the offender. We now have some consistency across the board, and we have investigators that deal with the complainant right through the court processes, which makes it far more supportive. So I was there for quite some time rolling out that model, which you'll probably hear referred to as the SOCKET model, which is what we run with now in Victoria. So Task Force SANO, or SANO, depending which kindergarten you went to, it has been in the media quite a lot lately with George Pell. Clearly I can't speak about that current case, but initially Task Force SANO was set up to investigate institutional child sexual abuse, which started with the Catholic Church and then expanded across many other institutions across the state. So it's not just the Catholics. It was also other institutions.
Hi, everyone. Can everyone hear me? I won't talk much about my new role, which is at Family Violence Command, doing the implementation from the Royal Commission. Unless you've got some questions at the end, I'm happy to talk about that. I'll talk mainly tonight, because it's on theme, about my work over the last 4 years with the sex offence team at Melbourne Prosecutions. And as Magistrate Wallington said, it was set up in response to the Law Reform Commission, and when the court set up their specialised court, we set up our specialised team, and I was a member of the team, and then I managed that team for the last 4 years. So we prosecute matters that are in the Magistrates Court and the Children's Court to do with sex offences. Right up in the Magistrates Court, the jurisdiction, probably the most serious offences there are child exploitation material offences, so the making of or possession of those offences, and indecent assaults or sexual assaults on children. And so we have a lot of child victims or child complainants that come to court, and we prosecute those matters and bring the evidence to the court for those matters. In the Children's Court, the jurisdiction involves higher level matters, so we where the children are the offenders in the matters of rape, and so I have experience prosecuting those matters at court as well as managing the other prosecutors who are doing those serious matters. We also do a lot of, because of the legislation changes in the early 90s, some offences that would have been in the higher jurisdiction are actually lower jurisdiction because of the change in offences. So some of the historical matters which would be rape now weren't rape then, and so we get a lot of historical matters where people have reported maybe 20 or 30 years later, and we'll prosecute those matters as well.
Thank you. Okay, so some of you may have seen Broadchurch, the third series of Broadchurch.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was the recent UK police show, and the reason I mention it, apart from the fact that it was fantastic, was that it was sort of based around, as those of you who've seen it would know, based around some really interesting depictions of the sort of very more holistic and trauma-aware investigative practices that are now being used in the UK in relation to rape allegations. And I believe there have been, I think some of you already flagged that, quite a number of reforms in Victoria. And for instance, I've sort of come across that idea of a multidisciplinary centre, a sort of holistic approaches to investigation to address a lot of those concerns that we've already been aware of in terms of some of the ways in which the prosecution process has been seen as being very damaging in the past. Is anyone able to just sort of talk us through some of the recent reforms in Victoria?
I'll touch on some of the Victoria Police reforms. The multidisciplinary centres, or MDCs, we like to use acronyms for everything in VicPol, so bear with me. The MDCs essentially were set up so we have an integrated response. Everything isn't siloed, and so our complainant's not having to travel to four different venues in order to get counselling or have a medical done or to make a statement. So the MDCs have been a very welcome thing in the state for support for our complainants. They're an off-site location, so they're not at a police station. It means a complainant doesn't have to come to the police station that has the big sign out the front that says police. And everyone in there is in plain clothes. There's no uniform members there. So encompassed in that are child protection workers, specialist investigators with Victoria Police, and CASA counselling, which are the counsellors for the complainants that have been sexually assaulted. And some of the MDCs also have medical rooms where our doctors can come out and conduct the medical on site, again, without having the complainant having to go somewhere else. Also, I spoke earlier about the reforms around the training of the police. So we've done quite a lot of training in what we call the whole story. I think we've trained over 500 police officers in this whole story theory, and we've also conducted some training with the judiciary so that they understand about this whole story, which in a nutshell is essentially allowing the complainant to put some context around their sexual assaults, and not just having to focus on the actual incident but being able to put context around it, particularly for incest matters or sexual assault matters that have been ongoing for quite some time. I'm sure Her Honour will probably talk about the court reforms.
The whole story change in the way that evidence is taken from complainants has been a really big innovation, I think. And what it means is it allows a complainant, I think generally speaking, we're all still subject to stereotypes and myths about sex offending, about sex offenders and about victims and how they should react to sex offences. And the whole story really will allow a complainant to go into the background as to how the perpetrator was able to offend against them, the techniques they used, the grooming process, the way they managed to keep their silence. So I think it's been a phenomenal success in terms of putting that story and counteracting a number of the myths and stereotypes. We have a long way to go. I think it's an area that is very gendered, and might I say the judges that have made and more recently interpreted the law have in the main been male, That's not to say that females aren't affected by these stereotypes either. I think they're so pervasive, it's a trap we can all fall into. And just last week, I had to almost slap myself because I was reading a brief with a, 20-year-old boy, 15-year-old girl. They were neighbours, they were mates, they had a few drinks and they had sex, and his mother was saying, oh, everyone makes mistakes. And I could really see that situation just happening. And her insightful, feisty mother in her statement said, I told her, no, it's not your fault. You didn't allow it to happen. Just because you had a drink didn't mean you wanted to have sex with him. These people use techniques to get make people vulnerable and make sex offending happen. So lots of stereotypes. Delay has been a major one that has been a stereotype or a myth about how a sexual assault complainant should react. We now know from the Royal Commission that children don't disclose. Sometimes they never disclose. The Royal Commission gave this incredible statistic that on average it takes 33 years for someone who's offended against as a child to disclose to someone. And yet our criminal justice system regarded sexual assault complainants, i.e. women, and children as an unreliable class of witnesses and said that delay was a matter affecting their credibility. So slowly we're working our way into the 21st century and having a bit of a balance between those patriarchal myths. And as I said, I'm not exempt either. We have to just battle against them on a daily basis. But judges should be leading the way and not undermining reforms in that area, is my view.
I might just add one thing, if I may. It's important to note, especially for the budding writers out there, that a jury is actually informed now that a delay is not to be taken into account. So that's a significant reform that we've had in Victoria. It was never previously mentioned at any trials. So a judge will now inform the jury that they must not take into account that it's taken X number of years for this complainant to come forward. It's much like you have to disregard the fact that a defendant or an accused is not going to give evidence. It's not to be taken into account. So that's been a significant reform for us.
I might talk a little bit about the prosecution. We do whole story as well. So all the prosecutors on the sex offence team do 3 days of training that involves the whole story as well. And the way that it helps us is that we're able to talk really or get out of the complainants when they're giving evidence about their counterintuitive behaviour, that freezing that you might read about, that when you read about court cases where the victim did nothing, the victim didn't scream, the victim didn't move. So it's, often that victim-blaming mentality that why didn't you fight? And so we do a lot of explain what you were thinking, tell us how you were feeling, why? And, a lot of the time the explanation is so clear and so relevant and it's so credible that I think the whole story has really helped all of us do our job better. I think that we've come so far in the last 10 years with the way that we, all of us, Victoria Police, the judiciary, the prosecutions, really see these matters, and we are going in the right direction. We might not be completely there yet, but the way we look after our complainants and the way that we balance the system, but also give the complainants the best service we can. We're doing well.
Thank you. I was just wondering, Marnie, you mentioned one of these reforms, as you said, was a reform to the way in which juries helped to kind of make sense of what they're hearing. And I think Victoria has really led the way with actually legislating about directions to juries. Could you just tell us a bit more about what's been put in place there to sort of help juries make sense of this? As you've all mentioned, that there's the stereotypes, there's the prejudices, there's the, you know, we all think, oh, this is a common sense explanation of what we're hearing, and juries somehow have to make sense of that when they're deciding on the facts. So other comment there about what the Jury Directions Act's actually required courts to tell juries?
Sure. Just to set up what the court system looks like for those of you that haven't been involved, once the committal has gone through the magistrate's court and it's the accused has been committed to trial, it will go to the county court where there are jurors. It's worth mentioning some further reforms that we've made in relation to child victims who are not required to give evidence in that court in front of the jury. We have a separate hearing for those victims, which is called a special hearing. And that special hearing is videotaped and that tape is played to a jury. So at no time does the child have to give evidence in front of those 12 people or in front of the defence or the prosecution. They're also remote. They're not in the courtroom. And they've got support services around them in a remote facility where they video link into court. And even with adult sexual assault victims, they only have to see the prosecutor and the judge or the defence lawyer and the judge when they're being cross-examined. So I think that's worth noting that we've made some significant reforms in trying to make complainants feel as comfortable as possible when they give evidence, go for it.
And it's actually compulsory for the victims, even adult victims, to be remote. So it's just unless they get special permission. So we actually, if a victim wants to be in court with the accused, we have to ask and make a special application to the magistrate with good reason for them to be in the court. Otherwise, they are not in there.
It's the default position because it's assumed that it will be easier to give evidence from a remote witness facility. I don't know that they have to be given permission. I could be wrong, but they have to be... They actually have to positively say they want to be in the courtroom. But just being in the courtroom doesn't mean they'll be giving evidence in public. It's mandatory for the court to be closed when a complainant of a sexual offence gives evidence. They're entitled to a support person. There's the witness assistance service, which is run by the OPP. And this July is the 10th anniversary of the Child Witness Service, which is a specialist organisation set away from the court. They have their own offices. They're child-friendly. They meet the child. They're referred to the Child Witness Service before the court date, so a rapport is established. The whole process, which must be like being on Mars for a child to be in the court process, is explained to them so it's not quite so terrifying and alien. And they get supported throughout the process by these wonderful women from the Child Witness Service from beginning to end.
Now I'll actually answer the question that you asked me. Sorry, I went off on a tangent. There have been some significant amendments to the Juries Act. At the end of a trial, a judge will always what we call charge the jury. So they'll do a summation of the case and they will kind of lead the jury down a legal path to make legal determinations such as consent. A lot of jurors sometimes ask, what does reasonable belief mean? What is consent? And so a charge to the jury will cover off on all of these things that juries sometimes find difficult because they're very subjective. What now happens is if consent is not an issue in a trial, then the judge will not bring that up in his charge to the jury. We found a lot of juries were getting confused, and that confusion was pointless because the Crown case and the defence case were not based on consent. So why are we bothering confusing the jury with consent? And sometimes a charge to a jury can go, a day. It's very long and it's sometimes quite dry because it's a lot of legal speak for the 12 lay people that have sometimes listened to a trial go on for 2 or 3 weeks. So we found we were getting a lot of cases we were losing a lot, quite frankly, because juries were confused at the end. They thought they knew what decision, whether that was not guilty or guilty, and then they were changing their minds because the charge to the jury was so confusing to them. So that's been very much clarified under the Juries Act, which we're very happy about, and consent is not brought up if it's not on issue.
No, thank you. Perhaps to move to an area that you've sort of mentioned in passing, I'm sort of interested in the sorts of offences that we find coming up under the sort of umbrella concept of sexual offences. And it would seem to me, more from, I guess, reading the papers, but also from hearing some of your comments, particularly, Kare, that child pornography seems to be a really big new problem, kind of a newish problem, and the internet and social media, these all seem to be raising new areas for sexual offending. So I was just interested in your thoughts on that, the work that's going on in that area.
There's a lot of emerging offences that come from, I refuse to call it pornography, child exploitation material. I think the word pornography makes it, normalises it, because there's adult pornography and then there's child pornography. It's not, it's child exploitation material. There's children on the end of those cameras. Every child on the end of that camera is a victim of a sexual crime, and you'll hear me say that in court 100 times a day. And the problem with the internet is there's two parts of the internet. There's the normal internet, which everyone's using, and child exploitation material is being passed around freely. There's also the dark web, which is causing investigators throughout the world a whole lot of problems, because it creates a sort of seedy, hidden area where people can exchange images. There's also emerging offences where live streaming of on a basis where you pay a subscription to dial in via Skype or whatever the app is, you can request certain things to be done to the person or child that's on the end of the camera, and it's unpoliceable. It's a telephone call. It's not recorded, it hangs up and it's over. And so that is what is happening with the legislation is that legislation sort of moves as the offences emerge. So we put offences go through Parliament in place to try and stop these offences that are occurring, and the offenders go around it and find new ways to offend, such as using those live sites. There's new offences that are coming into on the 1st of July, new offences, and some of them are to do with administration of a child exploitation material website, so just which we haven't really been able to charge before. It's ever growing. My personal opinion, and it's not the opinion of Victoria Police, is that I think there's something to do with child exploitation material that feeds from what I've seen, well, from my experience, that people need more and more and more and harsher things, and younger kids, and it's very difficult to police the amount of stuff that's out there. We've got our divisional sockets that are looking that investigate it. We've got our joint anti-child exploitation team that work on the international stuff, and they've been responsible for saving 11 children. It's a fantastic job, but it is just an ever-growing, very difficult thing to police and prosecute.
The technologically assisted offences are probably our most rapidly increasing in terms of numbers. A lot of them are Commonwealth offences because they involve the use of a carriage service, that is, through the internet. Not just child exploitation images or child abuse images, but grooming and procuring of children on the internet. And it's funny, we like to think of Victoria as ahead in so many ways, and I do believe we are, but Each state has contributed something. Western Australia was far ahead in terms of some of the special measures to protect children in the court system. Queensland is the place that has led the way in terms of police going online, impersonating children and having that. It's not an entrapment because they're just the pretend child just sitting there whilst the pedophile, the predator, goes online and increasingly sexualises the communication to the point where often they make an arrangement to meet. The grooming charges are to arrest people before harm is done. So even though social media or the internet is exacerbating a lot of the sexual offences, it's also at least allowing some of these offenders to be caught, because some of it, even though there is the dark web and the problems with anonymity, often the traces they leave on social media are the best evidence to convict them also. We've also led the way in other offences, such as we have revenge porn legislation in Victoria. It's called distributing an intimate image without consent or threatening to do so. We have some new offences, Victorian grooming offence, which can cover electronic grooming, but also in-person grooming, also includes grooming someone in order to befriending an adult to get to their child, so it's quite wide-ranging. And perhaps something very few people know, but we all need to know, apart from the new offence of failing to protect children in an organisation, such as they did in the Catholic Church, in particular moving priests around from diocese to diocese, we now have a new failure to protect charge, but we also have a failure to report charge, and that is a duty that is incumbent on everyone over 18. If we have a reasonable belief that a child is being sexually abused, then we have a duty, and it is an offence now not to report it to police.
It's quite a significant shift, given that the position was always in the past that there was no active obligation to report. Mm-hmm. Yes, really significant. And I'm assuming those came out of the Royal Commission and the previous inquiry in Victoria in relation to institutional...
Those three offences, we had an earlier parliamentary inquiry in Victoria. It became known as the Betrayal of Trust Inquiry. So those three offences came out of that.
I might just add, from a policing perspective, to manage these individuals, whether it be on the sex offender registry, because historically pedophiles had to find children which to groom and to then sexually assault. Now with the web, it's just like shooting fish in a barrel. There are so many children out there that will be on their computer, and it's very easy for these men to engage with children online. They're what we call non-contact offences, and when they end up on the sex offender registry for these non-contact offences, to manage such a significant number, because we're just on the increase because it's so easy now to have access to children, that it's quite frightening, really, of how big it is getting and the resourcing required to kind of keep it in check.
Thank you. Well, I was actually thinking that that you've actually raised another really, well, many very interesting issues, but one being, what are our responses? What are the available responses to sex offending? And I think a lot of us would be aware of the sex offender register, whatever that is. So I was just sort of wondering if perhaps you could explain what is the sex offender register? How does someone get on it? Who puts them on it? And what happens when they're on it, and how do they get off it? What, all those sorts of questions.
I'll explain how you get on it.
Perfect.
Why you put them on it.
Perfect. We all have a part to play in getting someone on the register. I've just brought some figures along. So at present we have around about 6,800 people on the sex offender registry in Victoria. The serious sex offenders that my unit manage. There are around 120 at the moment, which are on a post-sentence scheme, which, again, we will get to, I promise. We do have females on the register. Quite often we get asked if there are females, and there are. Now we've got 131 females on the register at the moment. We don't have any juveniles, so no children on the register.
There have been.
They have, yes.
Period must have expired.
There have been some children, but the test for children is very different. It's a very high test, and though there have been some, the length of time on the register is halved for children, and the very few kids who are on it, their time must... I find that quite heartening that we don't have children on the register, I must say.
So there were many questions there. The register essentially is... in order for us to ensure that there's sexual safety within the community. So we're able to manage these individuals on the register by knowing obviously their address, who they're living with, where they're working. We work very closely with the Working with Children in Victoria, with child protection. By way of example, if someone on the registry is single when they're put on the registry and then he meets someone and she has children, that's something that we need to know, because we need to know that he's now in a relationship where he has access to children, and then we can make a determination as to whether or not those children fit within his cohort of offending, and if so, put some protection in place, just by way of example. Do you want to talk about the prosecution of...
So to be put on the register, you have to commit a certain class of offence. There's four classes of offences, and for each one there's different time limits. So the lowest time limit is 8 years, and then it goes up to 15 years, and then there are a combination of offences that you can be put on the register for life. There's a number of offences where it's mandatory, so child exploitation material, rape offences, offences against children. You'll have some mandatory period of time on the sex offenders register if you're found guilty of those offences. There's some offences like a sexual assault where it's discretionary. And what will happen with that is at the end of the case, when the case is proven, it'll be an application by the prosecution to the magistrate or to the court in regards to this person being put on the registry. And the test there is whether they're at harm to the sexual safety or one or more Victorians. And so we'll make a submission saying this person, we feel, has committed this offence or may have a history of those, I hate to say lower level, has a history of sexual offences, maybe against adults, maybe a touch on the bottom or something like that. But we're saying that a number of Victorians are now at risk, and we'll make that application, and then it's up to the magistrate to make that order.
Segue to Belinda. Did you want to comment on how that works when you're in court?
Well, for magistrates, sometimes it's just a matter of writing a number in, because the sex offender registry is, or the sex offender registration act is a fairly blunt instrument, and it's nearly all mandatory. So I understand why we have a register, and I'm grateful that the people who run the registry will categorise offenders themselves in terms of which ones they need to keep an eye on. But in terms of these mandatory provisions, there's no distinguishing between low risk, medium risk, or high risk offending. They all get put on the register. Sometimes I have a difficulty because I'm trying to resolve matters and have people plead guilty to avoid women and children, and sometimes men, give evidence in court, and the prospect of being placed on the register can be an impediment. There are some incongruous things in our legislation, which means that occasionally people, I think people will have heard maybe of young boys or young men being put on for sexting. That not children, the police have been, I think, quite sensible, because children are madly sexting all the time. And until they changed the legislation, we were in the hands of the police and their common sense in terms of just speaking to children. They didn't even bring them to court. But because of the different definitions of a child is under 18, but a 16-year-old can have a consensual relationship. So you can have a 16-year-old girl in a consensual relationship with a 19-year-old, but if he sends or receives a photo, then he may be in possession of child pornography. There has been a little bit of move, and there are also some unlawful sexual relationships where you wouldn't think that the person was a sexual risk. An immature 18-year-old with a 15-year-old girl, should they be on the sex offence register for 8 or 15 years? Personally, I don't think so. And the legislation will change, so for those that small category of young person, 18 or 19-year-old person who at the moment would be put on the register, can apply for to be exempted from it. But it's just a small group of people who'll be able to do that.
Thank you. Well, I think that's raised one of the, a sort of key issue in this area, as in any area of criminal justice, which is the sort of concepts of balancing various interests, you know, the community interests in punishment, community interests in sort of rehabilitation so people don't reoffend and so on, community concerns about safety, and I think that's highlighted by Belinda's comments about how we use a sex offender register, and is it a useful thing to have mandatory requirements to have sort of blanket provisions. So moving from that end to sort of the other end, Victoria has introduced, or quite some time ago introduced, serious sex offender legislation that allows people to be, as I understand it, to be locked up even though they've finished their sentence. Now, we're obviously concerned about community safety, but we also would normally have a principle that once you're done your time, the state has no more power over you. So I'm sort of interested in how those processes work, and I think we're extending it with the Harper Review. We're going to be extending those sorts of powers to serious violent offenders as well, so having a capacity to actually keep them locked up even though they've actually finished their sentence. So I'm sort of interested in how that works. I think that's an area that you're working in, sort of how that works. Is it acceptable? Is it useful? Is it effective? Sorry, I want to ask lots more questions, and I asked too many questions all in one hit.
So he retired Judge His Honour, Justice Harper, conducted a review after an individual that was on a post-sentence scheme raped and murdered a young Yugoslavian girl as a result of the Premier asking His Honour to conduct this review. The Harper Review came out of that. There were 35 recommendations from the Harper Review, which my unit, in conjunction with Corrections Victoria, are implementing these recommendations across the state. Locked up isn't quite right. We actually don't lock them up. We have facilities in Victoria where these serious sex offenders they do have to be escorted when they leave. However, it isn't a jail. It's not a prison. It's a facility that allows them to have treatment. It gives them access to education, and it integrates them, having come out of custody, back into the community without kind of opening the door from the jail and saying, good luck, and off they go. It allows us to have better management of them, and above anything else, it allows for the sexual safety of the community, because we're able to manage them far more easily. Not all of the individuals on supervision orders are in these facilities. Some are living out in the community, which my unit manage. And again, it's first and foremost to ensure the safety of the community, but it's also to help integrate these men back into the community in the safest possible manner through an integrated response as far as therapeutic treatment with sexual and forensic psychologists. And yes, we are looking at one of the recommendations from the Harper Review is to extend this scheme to incorporate violent offenders, which would kind of mirror what we've got at the moment with the supervision orders, but it would encompass our serious violent offenders that are released from jail.
So is that one area where we're using electronic monitoring? I've never been sure how widely that's being used in Victoria.
Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in that case, they would be in the community, but with tags on, or they, yeah.
Yes, they.
I don't know how it works.
They do. They have monitoring. They wear monitoring devices so that it assists us in the management of them.
Would either of the other panel like to comment on that?
Mm-hmm. Just a minor point. This is the Serious Sex Offenders Detention and Supervision Act. But in fact, I think there's only one person in detention.
Two.
The rest are on the supervision orders, and these are people who are high risk offenders. They've offended multiple times. They often really do have a deviant problem, and it's probably very good for the community, I suspect, that they're being closely supervised.
I might just add, if I might, the threshold to have these individuals put on a supervision order is extremely high. We go to the county court for supervision orders and the Supreme Court for detention orders. So the threshold for us to apply to have these men put on supervision orders is extremely high, and rightly so. It should be quite a high threshold for us to reach to have someone on this scheme once they've served their sentence.
Great, thank you. And I'm in the fortunate position of having control of the questions. So I've got one more, and then I'm going to stop and open up the questions to the floor. So I guess leading on from that question, I think we have this, you know, this debate in the community about what the aims of the criminal justice system are, what the aims of sentencing are, and there's obviously a lot of a strong focus on issues of punishment and community protection as well. The idea of, you know, that harsher penalties, that longer sentences and so on will automatically make us safer. But we're also aware that most people actually do, other than the ones you're referring to, ultimately come back into the community. And we also want people then to be not reoffending. Yeah, we want to punish them harshly, but we also want to make sure that when they come out, they're somehow not going to offend again. And I'm aware that there are the treatment options, therapeutic options, rehabilitation options. I'd just be interested in your comment on, I guess, what the sentencing options are to the courts in Victoria. What are the range of ways in which we try to respond to sexual offending?
I spent 6 years at the Children's Court and set up a sex offence list there, and you wouldn't necessarily think we would need one, but we do. Children do offend, and they offend against other children, and usually quite young children. So for two reasons, we had a very therapeutic model in that court. And the two reasons were, one is that the evidence in terms of sexual treatment of adolescent offenders was fairly strong, that they responded well, and the recidivism rate was low if they were in treatment. And the other was just a pragmatic thing to protect children. If you have children offending against other children, then the victims are very young, and we did not want them coming along to court to give evidence if they were 5, 6, or 7. So the whole thrust of that sex offence list, there were times when we did lock up people, but the whole thrust was really to use the system to coerce or encourage, but coerce these kids into treatment, and I think we were quite effective in doing that. In the adult system, well, We have a presumption of harm. Child sexual abuse causes significant harm, and I think if you go to court having offended against a child, particularly in the sort of offence that sees you in the county court, then there is an expectation that you are going to be locked up. But they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can have punishment combined with rehabilitation, sex offender programs as part of parole, or reduce the sentence. If someone pleads guilty, then that's a strong mitigating factor. It does indicate some sort of remorse, so maybe a shorter sentence. We have community corrections orders that we can make now that are quite intensive, and we can have them come back before the court. There's a new condition you can attach to a corrections order called judicial monitoring, so you have them come back to court every couple of months to make sure they are in treatment.
Other comments? I guess we have to be a little careful around commenting on sentencing. Lucky you and I don't do any of the sentencing. That's right. We'd run out of room. It's a difficult balance for the judiciary, and I know Her Honour and I were talking the other night about sentencing, and it's a balance that they have to strike. I think the media put microphones in the face of the mother that's lost her son in a car accident from someone that's still alive that was drunk or drug affected that killed her child, or a mother who's had their daughter raped and murdered. Of course they're going to say, we want him locked up for 150 years. I mean, that is a completely natural reaction. And in reality, it's unrealistic. We don't have sentences like that in Victoria. So it kind of puts an unrealistic expectation on the community of what our judiciary do. I mean, sure, they can at times give sentences that everyone shakes their head about, but I guess we need to remember they've got a lot of things to weigh up when they're sentencing individuals, and certainly looking into the future, having them come back into the community, I think has to be at the forefront of their mind, because the chances that they are going to have to integrate again is very high. So whilst it should be punitive, we also have to think about realistic sentences and not locking someone up for 50 years and then expecting us to welcome them back into the community with open arms when they're completely broken.
Thank you. Well, that's been really terrific, and thank you very much. What I'd like to do now is to open it up, give it to you in terms of questions for the panel. So if you could, you've got our roving mic. So if you could just put your hand up, and you need to stand up, and we'd like you to say what your name is, and then the panel will answer your questions. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name's Carmel, and I wouldn't not normally ask a question because I'm a convener, but this has been burning on me for 20 years. So nearly 20 years ago, a barrister called Mark Taft argued before the judge that the rape victim really didn't suffer because she was unconscious at the time. The judge said, oh, yes, and gave the rapist a community order, and then he then went and committed a similar sort of rape whilst on the community order within months. And that barrister's now a judge. Anyway, I want to know, is that sort of thing likely to happen now or not?
It can't happen now. So it's written into the legislation that if someone's unconscious that they can't give consent. There's a whole lot of legislation around consent, and that alcohol-affected, drug-affected, yeah, you can't give consent if you're unconscious. I don't know if anyone's seen the YouTube clip about drinking tea. If you haven't seen it, Google it. It is the best thing to show your children. I always say the most important thing you should teach your girls is consent, and the most important thing you should teach your boys is consent. Show them that video. It's fantastic. It's the English version of teaching consent regarding drinking tea?
I don't think it would happen these days, and one of the reasons why is because the Sentencing Act has been changed so that a sentencing judge or magistrate must consider the effect of the offending on the victim, and in case they're not bright enough to get that, the victim has the right to make a victim impact statement and have either read it out in court or have someone read it to the court. So there is no excuse for ridiculous submissions of that nature in our courts these days.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Eileen Ormsby. Thank you, all three of you, for what you do. My question is mostly for Marnie and Kire. For a non-fiction author who is interested in talking to people on a task force of a completed investigation, what's their best way of approaching somebody, and who would they approach?
In a dark alley? No.
I think probably through our media unit would be the best. Oh, God bless you, media unit. They're the best media unit in the world. Would that be right, to go through media? Yep, I'm getting big nods.
Many years ago, I was at the bar, and I remember acting for a sex offender, and we managed to keep him out of jail by putting him on a kind of voluntary chemical castration program. I'm not sure if that still happens, but does it work? Could it work? Isn't that a better way of protecting the community?
I don't know about chemical castration, but I do know that there's something called a community treatment order, and that is where people who suffer from some sort of mental illness, that they have an order from the court that requires them to attend and get whatever medicine that they need. And so if that medical condition or mental illness is given as mitigation factor in court or for bail, then the court can order that they attend. However often the doctor says they need to get their medicine, and if they don't, they're breaching that order and they're brought back before the court. I don't think it's to do with chemical castration, though.
Hello there, my name's Ruth, and my question is a little bit left of field, probably. At the moment, I'm researching and writing a book about the impact of serious crime on the professionals who investigate it, including the police. And very recently, I've been interviewing a detective or a former detective who was heavily involved in child exploitation crimes. And some of what she told me still gives me nightmares. So I'm curious to know how you cope, given that a lot of what, yeah, and I know it's a really random question, but a lot of what the cases that she talked about didn't even get to court because for lack of evidence. So I'm interested in whether or not the police have improved in the way they look after you.
Certainly from when I first started working in investigating sex offenders in the 90s, where we had nothing, to now in 2017, we've improved significantly. I know the investigator you're talking about, and I've worked with her, and VicPol have really gone out of their way to make it now you don't feel weak if you ask for help now in our line of work, which I think was probably the biggest hurdle for investigators. You were seen as the weak link if you couldn't cope with looking at child exploitation material day in, day out. We get a lot of vicarious trauma because we're listening to victim stories every day, and sometimes we're taking statements that can take 2 or 3 days to compile, and we're obviously getting into very, very fine-grained detail about what's happened to these people. So absolutely there's vicarious trauma. It can affect your relationships outside of work, but certainly the stigma of seeking help inside our organisation has changed significantly, and now it's really, you're almost looked at as being not normal if you haven't sought help. And we've also brought in maximum time in position in a lot of our sexual assault areas. So again, I'm going to use some acronyms, but JACET, which is the Joint Task Force that do our online work, they have maximum time in position. My position with the serious sex offenders has maximum time in position. So once we hit 5 years, we have to move on and work somewhere else, and that's to stop that vicarious trauma.
Can I just ask, would that be the case for the judges as well?
We have access to counselling. We also can just debrief amongst ourselves. The former chief judge of the county court led the way in. They had a pilot in terms of compulsory, because once again, we're a bit behind the police force. There seems to be some stigma in putting your hand up and saying that you need some help. But the chief judge had a pilot where it's compulsory, and he made himself part of it. So if you go, I'm sure there it would help.
And I will say the beautiful colleagues that I work with Corrections Victoria, who just are a fantastic organisation. My unit is embedded into Corrections, and they have mandatory counselling sessions. So VicPol have not gone down that path. I could talk to you for an hour about that, but there isn't really any evidence to show that making people go to talk to a counsellor necessarily works. We've more taken the path of removing that stigma and saying, encouraging you to go and giving you easier access to that sort of help, rather than mandating all of my investigators to sit with somebody.
In regards to prosecutions, what we do is we bring the police psychology unit to all of our training sessions, and also once a year a meeting of the sex offences team, and we bring the police psychology unit in, and they speak to everyone, and they give they've got fact sheets, and they give tips in regards to when you're viewing, what you're viewing. And really, my advice to any of the team, and you know, myself, if you don't have to look at it, don't look at it. It's a bit different from the investigators who have to look at it and class it all. We don't always have to view it as prosecutors. Sometimes we do. We always have someone with us, so never look at it alone. I think it's a good one.
Hello, my name's Holly. I study law here at the university. I was just curious, with Stacey Tierney being in the news of late, the sex worker who was found, you know, murdered, are sexual offences against sex workers handled any differently, and are they taken as seriously as any other case from the point of first point of contact all the way through the court process? Do you have anything sort of...
Absolutely, they're treated with exactly the same as any other complainant. I think what people don't understand is particularly street workers are they're easy prey for people. They're the most vulnerable people, some of the most vulnerable people in the community. And it's far easier for that offender who's going to rape someone that nobody seems to care about. No one notices when she doesn't turn up to work, and they have a view that society don't care about them. But absolutely we do, and we obviously do a significant amount of sexual assault investigations related to prostitution, particularly street prostitution. And I think they get an unfair deal in the media and through the community because they're raped because it's easy to rape them.
My name's Andrew. I'm just wondering, for all the panellists, what the effect of, over the last couple of decades, the institutional, or the revelation of the institutionalised sex offences and the offences committed by high-profile people that have very much come out. Is that, or what is your opinion on the effect of that in your work with the, does it free any of the people involved to feel more comfort? Does it feel, make victims feel more comfortable about coming forward, or do you think it helps people be more comfortable with mandatory reporting? Or does it help lower the number of offences because more of the perpetrators now might understand that, hey, I shouldn't be doing that in the first place? I know that's a sort of...
There's three questions there. I'll do my best. I think with the historical offences, I think more than anything it's encouraged people to come forward, and I think that's a fantastic thing, that seeing those royal commissions and seeing the victims come forward, it gives everybody, any victim, a little bit of confidence that they're going to be believed, and I think that's fantastic. Whether it stops offenders offending, I don't know if it does, but... maybe it does. I don't know. I don't think so.
I think what it has done is made some men in particular who were abused as young boys, whether that be in boarding school or in a church context or through other organisations, they didn't realise there wasn't a statute of limitations, and there isn't. And so they see some people come forward and they think, wow, the police are actually going to take a statement from me for something that happened 40 or 50 years ago. I can say it at Task Force SANO, even if an offender was deceased, we would still take a statement from that individual. It was cathartic. The community and the government had never listened to these particular young boys. They're also girls abused, so I'm not saying there weren't girls abused, but particularly for men that try to bottle up what happened and haven't shared it with anyone for many, many years, just the sheer fact that the police came and cared and spent 2 days taking a statement that wasn't ever going to go anywhere because we couldn't prosecute anyone, I think was a really important stepping stone for us as a society, the government and the police, and I think the courts.
I think people feel safety in numbers, that there's other people there that they're going to be believed because there's someone standing beside them saying the same thing.
My name is Darcy Ehrlich, and my story has been in the news quite a bit. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Mal Khalifa, my former school principal, who has 74 counts of sexual assault against her and was helped to flee Australia before she fled to Israel. And has evaded extradition since by claiming that she has had panic attacks and hasn't been able to face court. Recently I had a meeting with the Director of Public Prosecutions, and he told me that legally there's no room to move and politically is the way to go. Australia needs to put more pressure on Israel to honour their treaty. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions for me in regards to how I can move forward with this issue.
I think it's probably best, maybe you and I might speak at the completion. It's difficult for me to talk about A because it involves the director, and I'm not overly familiar with your case, but I'll be happy to talk to you at the end to see if there's something I can suggest.
Hi, my name's Kate. I was following a recent case that has completed in another state where, from my take on it, it seemed to be that it was accepted that the female had not consented, but that the perpetrator had not understood she had not consented. So I just wanted to make sense of that a little bit more. How much weight is given to the alleged or the actual offender having to understand that the person hasn't consented, and is there a requirement for that person to, or the person attacked or raped, to have to prove that aspect? That just seemed a new surprising thing to me. I hadn't heard of that, and I'm sure you know the one I'm talking about recently where the person was found not guilty. It involved King's Cross and nightclub areas.
Right. Well, there are a number of elements of an offence, and for sexual assault, the lack of consent is one of them, but there's also the fault element for the offender. And until very recently in Victoria, we had, as in other states, a complicated and subjective test in terms of an offender being, what was the test, being aware that whilst the prosecution has to prove every element, and they had to prove that the offender was not aware that the person was consenting or might not be consenting. But it wasn't an objective test, it was a subjective test in working out whether it was an honestly held belief. the element of reasonableness had to be taken into account, but it was only one small element. 2 years ago, we changed that in Victoria and now is an objective test. The prosecution have to prove that the person did not reasonably believe that the complainant was consenting. And another part of that reform was to add, because a lot of men will say, well, I had been drinking, so I really did believe at the time that she was consenting, and I may have been mistaken, but, you know, given my state, it was reasonable and honest that I had this erroneous belief. Well, self-induced intoxication is not an excuse. The reasonable belief has to be the reasonable belief of a person in those circumstances who is not intoxicated. So I think that will make a big difference.
My name is Viv. My question is to Your Honour. I think that any victim who came before you would be extremely lucky, and I'm wondering about other judges and what kind of training they get to around... Yeah, do they have training? Do they learn about stereotypes and questioning their own assumptions and their own prejudices?
We do. That's relatively new for judges too, because the old style judge just had conferred upon them this incredible wisdom, and they had no need to be educated. But in the last, I don't know how many years, probably 15 years, we've accepted that we are mortal, that we're just as likely to be subjected to stereotypical or misconceived thinking, and we now have, just next door, I think, the Judicial College of Victoria, which is responsible for educating us on a regular basis. So there's a lot to be educated on, and tackling those misconceptions is just one of them. But in my role as supervising magistrate for sex offences, I can make suggestions to our education committee, and I know that in July we are having a session on that very thing in terms of what's appropriate questioning to allow in court, and becoming more interventionist in stopping inappropriate cross-examination. But having said that, it is a balancing act. Really, it is so hard to talk about being sexually offended against, let alone be asked questions. But still, the evidence does have to be tested. We need to have a trial that's fair to both parties. We can't just say, I've been sexually offended against, here's my statement, and 10 years jail, please. It's a process. It's a flawed process. It's not the best process, but it is a process that we have to juggle.
Now, I've just realised the time. It's been so interesting. We can allow one question, which is going to have a very quick response, and then we need to wind up because there's a couple of other things that need to be done. So whoever's got the mic now will be the last person. But the speakers may well stick around briefly afterwards if people have questions too. I'm not committing you to it.
Hi, my name's Janae. First of all, as the mother of two small children, I just want to say thank you so much for the work you do. It must be heartbreaking and soul-destroying to see what you see daily. So, you know, I couldn't do it, so I thank God that there are people like you that can when that happens. But my question's more about, you touched on earlier about how far VicPol and to some degree the courts have come in the investigation and prosecution of sexual assault. But we still see the defence, you know, still questioning women's, the way they dress, their sexual preferences, whether they were drunk. You know, do you ever think there'll come a time in court where that stuff won't turn up anymore, where the victim blaming things will stop, so it's easier for them to, you know, give their evidence?
I'm sure Her Honour will have a response to this as well, but some of the reforms we've made is that the defence are no longer able to ask those sorts of questions. They can't talk about the clothing if it's not relevant to the defence. They can't talk about her prior sexual history. So there are a lot of questions that are off limits, because we've got to remember not so long ago an accused could represent themselves in a rape trial. Like, how horrible. So that accused could actually cross-examine that victim in the witness box. So now there are quite stringent criteria around what a defence counsel can and can't ask. But I think Her Honour touched on it before. It's a difficult balancing act, because we still have to have a fair trial for an accused. It's kind of the foundation of our whole legal system, and evidence has to be tested. It's really important that it is tested. And so we have to strike a balance between being able to cross-examine someone that is giving evidence in chief, but making sure that it's not re-traumatising that complainant, and keeping it respectful and keeping it relevant. And if it has no relevance, then it shouldn't be asked, and it shouldn't be allowed by the trial judge. And the trials I've been involved in, I've seen that change quite substantially. Again, we still have a long way to go, and I think that the judges will admit they still have room to improve, as does everyone's organisation, but we're getting there.
Thank you. And I think on that very helpful note, that really summarised, we're really running...
Can I say one other thing? Sure. Just for anyone who is interested in any further information, I believe, and the media unit might tell me more, but in July there's going to be a series of podcasts that are all dedicated to sex offences and the investigation and victims and complainants, and I think they go for between half an hour and an hour, and there's going to be 10 of them. So they're coming out in July through the Victoria Police website, is that right? So if you're interested in learning more about what we do and how we do it, that's somewhere where you can get some more information.
Thank you, Corey. That's terrific. That's terrific information. Can I thank all the panellists? Can I ask you to thank all the panellists?